number that we need to read out, but it is there.
Yes, thank you very much. I wanted to conform to the title and the program.
About 20 minutes, that okay?
Yes, 20 minutes will be fine.
About a 3-minute note.
Yeah, thank you. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak here. It's a very interesting meeting, and I've already learned quite a bit from the presentations this morning and even just now, and I hope to say a few words that are in some way complementary to those that have already been stated. Conditions in the United States are extremely interesting at the moment, if you can maintain a certain detachment and macabre sense of humor, it helps. But it is necessary, if you wish to appreciate the current political developments, to pass beyond the analytical stage, which is depicted here. And that feat is, anyone who has been observing political discourse in the American media recently, well beyond the capacity of many participants in that discourse. But I suppose it's an obligation of scholarship as represented in this room. Now, one tendency which I would suggest is perhaps the dominant tendency, certainly a very prevalent one in mainstream discussion, is to treat our incumbent president, Mr. Trump, as a kind of accident of history, a blip in the space-time continuum, and at the same time, a threat to a legitimate and established and successful order in the American Republic, which, by the same analytical frame, remains intact and expects to be returned to power when the blip fades away, and either partly through the midterm elections that will be coming up in a few weeks, and partly perhaps the rest of the way in the presidential elections of 2020, unless, of course, the process of a return to normality is disrupted once again by another blip, one that might be named, for example, Bernie Sanders. This is very much the view that is prevalent in the Democratic Party at the present time. And I think it usefully helps to us to understand the obsessive evocation of the Deus ex machina that is supposedly responsible for the outcome of the 2016 election, or should I say, of the Russians ex Facebook. And its consequence is a party which is desperately trying to renew itself, or perhaps it's better to say pretend to renew itself, by replacing its previous candidate, Hillary Clinton, with, say, a fresh face in the form possibly of Joe Biden, possibly of John Kerry, and similarly young and energetic new leadership. Or perhaps even, as we learned from reading the press in the last few days, not to replace Hillary Clinton at all. She's definitely back on the road. I would suggest that there is a parallel here. Mainstreams tend to be homologous in the way that they think to the dominant view in the economics profession, which is governed by a model that is known as the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model. It's a view of a world which has a stable central tendency, which can be disrupted from time to time by adverse events, including what are sometimes called black swans, that is to say, things that nobody could have foreseen. And Donald Trump represents a kind of black swan in this view in American politics. A rare, unpredictable event like the great financial crisis of 2007 and 2009, but not something from which one needs to learn any fundamental lesson. And I want to suggest that the same intellectual framework, these two parallel intellectual frameworks, share a parallel flaw, which is that they're fundamentally pre-scientific. They're fundamentally pre-evolutionary. They do not allow for the, if you like, the second law of thermodynamics, the single arrow direction of time. And to grasp what one might call the state of exception in American politics, one needs to take an institutionalist and an evolutionary view, something that in my tradition in economics is not at all unnatural, and to understand that the abrogation of the regular order in politics is an artifact or a consequence or at least a parallel development to the abrogation of the regular order in economic life. And one can go back to the early 1970s to describe the broad trends that have brought about those changes. They include the deindustrialization and decay of the Midwest, which has eroded the strength of the industrial working class in the United States, but also given it a very strong sense that the leadership of the Democratic Party does not have its interests at heart. The racial polarization of the South, which has had the same effect on the majoritarian white population, a process that began with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and was roughly complete in Texas, where I now live, by 1994, which was the last time any Democrat won an office at statewide elections. And what one has seen since then is the rise of a bi-coastal financial and technology-dominated economy with a very distinct partisan divide, which is just eminently visible in a map of the 2016 presidential vote, in which the counties that voted for Hillary Clinton are depicted in blue, and the ones that voted for Donald Trump are depicted in red. All along the East Coast, densely populated urban counties dominated by liberal professional classes and the financial sectors, insurance, real estate, and so forth, solidly Democratic. Along the West Coast, the industries are information technology, aerospace, entertainment, advanced industries that have turned that part of the country solidly Democratic over the past 30 years, and in between a vast expanse of relatively lightly populated, in most cases, rural and suburban regions that have become, with very limited exceptions, solidly Republican. The economic polarization, let me suggest, has a parallel that works through, in part, the rise of a digital media world, but beginning before that with the diffusion of cable television, that leads to a cognitive polarization. And this is something I think that is parallel to what Raphael Valim was saying about the state of exception legally being the representation of the neoliberal order. I would suggest that a cognitive polarization is a neoliberal commercial foundation of our political life. The work of a young professor at Merrimack College in Massachusetts, Zoe Sherman, has a very interesting paper in which she argues that the siloing of our communications channels is an artifact of commercial strategy. That is to say, it's an artifact of advertisers picking the most efficient way to target specific demographic niches in order to sell their products, and designing the political content of the cable news, the cable television stations, and other media channels to be narrowly attuned with that audience, thereby maximizing the efficiency of their advertising strategies. But at the same time, and as a byproduct, creating a set of distinct cognitive spheres in the country, that is to say, which are basically non-overlapping, in which entirely different interpretations of the same set of onrushing events are presented to different audiences who draw, obviously, very different political conclusions. This is not something which is new. This was very much how the country functioned in the antebellum period before the Civil War in the 19th century. It was a country that was organized with very different cognitive realities by section, by religion, by political tribes, and that resulted in the Civil War. But it was submerged thereafter following the defeat of the Confederacy. And in the 20th century, with the rise of radio and television, you had a kind of national homogenization enforced also by the periodic wars and by the discipline of the Cold War on American political discourse. So for a great long period from the World War I until the 1990s, there was a substantial national vision of things which was contested by political parties, and you had the world in which the median voter theorem was a relevant depiction of how, or at least somewhat relevant depiction of how political choices might be made. But now what has happened is that the older order, the previous order, and the one that did lead to the Civil War, has made a distinct reappearance. And a clear feature of this new and polarized reality is that the class structure of the competing spheres, one might call it the New York Times on the one side and the tabloids on the other, is very distinctly observable. So we have a professional class. It is the dominant political force in the blue counties for the most part, except for the impoverished ones in the Black Belt along the Mississippi and along the Texas border with Mexico. A dominant feature of most of the other Democratic counties. It has its own direct perception of economic and social conditions, which of course in this election was a perception of the relative success of American recovery from the 2008 debacle. And a strong sense of its own norms, its own social views, which are substantially more liberal than the rest of the country, and its own, a very strong sense of its own entitled position or its right to be the ruling element in the country. That is what, after all, institutions like Harvard or Yale, both of which I graduated from, do for people. They give you the sense that you have percolated up to the top of a society, and from that point forward, you should be naturally part, at least from time to time, of the ruling political elements. Now, an entitled ruling cadre is not necessarily illegitimate, but it becomes so, it can become so, as did happen, for example, in the USSR, if and as history and lived experience are falsified or suppressed to protect that cadre, and the falsehoods harden into myths and dogma that are nevertheless largely transparent or at least deeply suspected by the wider population. I would describe that as being the case in the USSR with respect to a large number of phenomena, including the Ukraine famine or the Gulag, until Solzhenitsyn came along to break open a discourse on those topics. And so it is in the US on a number of matters. The cognitive difficulties, I would argue, go back at least to the Kennedy assassination in 1963, if not before, and extend in much of the country to a view of our overseas commitments, misadventures, and wars. What we did to justify the war in Iraq is an example, and especially in the domain of economics to what one might call, and I'll come back to this, the state of exception that occurred in 2008 with the great financial crisis. You can't defend the legitimacy of an elite that is palpably viewed as dishonest and corrupt. And the US, which is curiously unlike post-war Germany in this respect, or for that matter even late Soviet and post-Soviet Russia, but perhaps more like post-war Japan, has apparent cultural, educational, and media environment that appears incapable of clearing itself of the accumulation of half-truths, outright falsehoods, unbelieved formulas and formalisms on which the position of the elite cadre has come to rest. So you have an entire group of professional political people whose discourse is met with a substantial amount of disbelief and contempt. And the result, of course, is that it is not surprising that there should be the rise of a figure whose central characteristic was his ability to convey and his willingness to project his contempt for those professional elites. There we are, fire and fury, ogon y argust. I couldn't resist taking a photograph of that in the Boris Yeltsin Museum in Ekaterinburg just a few days ago. So that's, I give you, you cannot escape the fire and fury, no matter how far from the United States you happen to be traveling at any given time. But what I want to say now is that there is, I think, an interesting economic dimension and a way to capture the effect of this polarization on American politics, and it's can be done by inspecting the changes in economic inequality that have occurred on a state-by-state basis, which is interesting in the United States, not because states are so much different from one another, but because we have the Electoral College and the presidential election is decided by the question of who gets a plurality in enough states to carry a majority of the Electoral College. So given that what we've observed is the rise of a populism of sorts, one might ask the question, how is it associated with the change in inequality in each of the states? That's a question that is difficult to answer, or at least was difficult to answer until recently, because there was no continuous annual data on the state of on inequality in the states, basically because many of the states are too small to be accurately measured by the annual household survey. But with my students and part of a project called the University of Texas Inequality Project, we went to different data sources, the employment and earnings, and used that to create a detailed and I think quite accurate picture of the movement of inequality on a state-by-state basis annually back to 1969. And what we did was to ask a very simple question. Is the change in inequality from 1990 to 2014 associated in any way with the electoral outcomes in 2016? And you can present the results very vividly on a little graph in which the proportionate change in inequality is given on the horizontal axis and the share of the Democratic vote of Secretary Clinton's vote in 2016 is on the vertical axis. The blue diamonds, sized by the scale of their presence in the Electoral College, are those states that were won by Hillary Clinton. The red circles are those that are won by Donald Trump. And you can see the labels here. What is interesting here is the 14 states with the biggest increases in inequality over this period, every single one of them voted for Hillary Clinton. So the reaction was not to inequality as such, at least not so far as one can make a direct connection to the kind of appeal that Donald Trump was making. It is rather that the demographic changes that were occurring in the country gave a plurality of votes in the more unequal states to the Democrats and a plurality of votes in a preponderance of the less unequal states to Donald Trump. Now, what's going on? You have a party, the Democratic Party, which represents the two tails of the income distribution. The upper income urban professionals, largely liberal on the one side, lower income minorities and immigrants on the other. More inequality means those numbers, those population proportions are larger, above 50%. That's a Democratic state. That's California, that's New York, that's New Jersey. It's Connecticut, Massachusetts, and a lot of other places. The states in the middle of the distribution that are largely rural and suburban and more ethnically homogeneous and without the finance and technology and the other highest income sectors, those states are in the Republican column. And it's a very straightforward kind of division, which gives you at least the potential, it seems to me, to assess which way things are going in the United States, assuming that we continue to have elections that actually count the votes, which is in some respects an open issue. But it poses a severe dilemma for the Democratic Party, because the states that Hillary Clinton narrowly lost in the upper Midwest are becoming less unequal, or at least more unequal at a much slower pace, and therefore drifting Republican. And so for the next Democratic candidate, however programmatically oriented to the disaffected working class they may be, they'll have a lower base of industrial working class votes to work with. The states in the South, including Texas, but also Georgia and North Carolina and Arizona, are becoming more unequal because of rapid growth of the cities and rapid growth of the immigrant and low and minority populations. And they're drifting Democratic. Texas is drifting at about 1% a year. But they're not close enough to the tipping point to make a difference. So the Democrats are going to be in a very tough position in 2020. It's going to be aggravated by the fact that between now and then, a very strong economy with no immediate signs of it falling apart is going to actually reduce the perceived inequality of the society, and that should further strengthen the Trumpian position, the Republican position. And so I would argue that we are in a state of exception, which is not a readily reversible condition, and that we should be prepared to deal with that reality for a very substantial period into the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.